Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report, special Friday edition for May 1st, 2020. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, Washington Governor Jay Inslee extends his statewide stay-at-home order for those not engaged in essential business through Sunday, May 31st. We'll hear Governor Inslee's entire press conference this afternoon and his announcement. And we'll also hear an extended interview with Latah County Commissioner Tom Lamar about the county's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and his response to a anti-social distancing rally held April 20th at the Moscow City Hall, organized by his Republican opponent in this fall's election for county commissioner. We'll have all that coming up on the KRFP Evening Report, but first this news. Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced today he will extend his statewide stay-at-home order until Sunday, May 31st. Inslee made the announcement at the beginning of a press conference at the state capitol. Although Governor Inslee said there will be a four-phase process to reopen the state's economy and that some counties without many COVID-19 cases will be able to apply to the state health department for variances from his order, Washington has not yet won the battle against COVID-19, and social distancing may have to continue after May 31st as well.
Today, I'm pleased to say that we are starting our careful, phased, science and data-driven process to reopen Washington's economy while we are remaining absolutely steadfast in our commitment to the health of Washingtonians. On Monday, I will issue a new extension of our Stay Home, Stay Healthy order, and this will allow us to take some initial immediate steps to begin reopening. We're turning the dial. Washington businesses will reopen in four phases, which I'll discuss today. And in addition, several smaller counties that have not been hit so hard by COVID-19 will be able to apply to the Department of Health for a variance from my order so that they can continue to open some of their operations. But I've got to just at the outset recognize something that all of we Washingtonians have to realize, and that we have not won this fight against this virus. Monday's order will continue a ban on public gatherings. Many businesses will have to remain closed. And that is why I'm extending the order through May 31st. I would like to tell you that we would all be able to make reservations on June 1st, but I cannot. We will have to continue to monitor and to assess the data on a daily basis and adapt as conditions allow. I would like to tell you that we would all be able to make reservations on June 1st, but I cannot. We will have to continue to monitor and to assess the data on a daily basis and adapt as conditions allow.
That was Washington Governor Jay Inslee speaking today at the state capitol. Inslee said the state needs to continue social distancing to keep the coronavirus from roaring back.
It's so frustrating that we don't want to do this twice. This is bad enough once. We should not take the risk to do this twice. And we have to make decisions based on hard-headed data and science and not wishes when it comes to life itself. And the hard-headed science tells us that we've got one decision to make here if we're going to continue on the road to recovery. And that's doing what we're doing. Make a cautious return of our businesses that we have set forth. We have already allowed the reopening of construction and hunting and golf. We've allowed the reopening of elective surgery. We're moving forward with some restricted matters as soon as in the next couple of weeks so that we can move forward on those protocols that we had. So we are making progress. We are opening businesses today. And this is a very rational approach moving forward. And that's how we have to make decisions.
That was Washington Governor Jay Inslee speaking today at the state capitol. We'll hear Governor Inslee's entire press conference later in this newscast. University of Idaho President C. Scott Green sent a lengthy letter to university faculty and staff today outlining his plan to reopen the university during the next 2 months. The plan has four steps parallel to Governor Brad Little's timeline and notes our progression through the two-week steps will be determined by the state and Idaho public health, and a resurgence of COVID-19 could slow the timeline. The letter says the goal is to return all employees to regular work locations by June 15th, but we must remain flexible, attentive, and proactive. Many of the decisions about events, travel, and engagement this summer will be up to the organizing unit. We should all plan for both the best case, hosting events and engagement, and the worst, cancellation close to the event date. For stage one, today through Friday, May 15th, the letter says, if you are able to work from home, you should continue to do so. Only those employees unable to work from home should return to work sites Monday, May 4th. Supervisors have the discretion to create work shifts, alternating assignments, or to temporarily reassign an employee to enhance safety and productivity. During the first two-week stage, the letter says, a face covering should be used when in direct contact with other people or when social distancing is not possible. All buildings will remain closed. No in-person university events will be held. Only essential travel will be permitted. Following the governor's guidance for travel and quarantine, classes will remain online remote. For the second and third stages, starting Monday, May 16th and Friday, May 29th, the sections start with, if you are able to work from home, you should continue to do so. Employees unable to work from home should continue working on site. Supervisors have the discretion to create work shifts, alternating assignments, or to temporarily reassign an employee to enhance safety and productivity. For the second phase, starting May 16th, the letter reads, a face covering should be used when in direct contact with other people or when social distancing is not possible. Some select buildings may open to the public with vice president approval. Meetings of up to 10 people can be held where social distancing can occur. Dining areas can open with approval of the vice president for finance and administration. No in-person university events will be held. Only essential travel will be permitted following the governor's guidance. Campus Recreation and Child Care Center are eligible to open, and further review will take place for how and when to accomplish this safely. For the third stage, beginning Saturday, May 30th, the letter also includes the advisory that face covering should be used when social distancing is not possible. Some buildings will open, it says, with the approval of the Vice President for Finance and Administration. In-person events can occur following the governor's guidance. Gatherings of up to 50 people where social distancing can occur. Travel will be permitted with supervisor approval and following the governor's guidance. The fourth and final stage of President Green's plan for the University of Idaho, which runs from June 14th through Friday, June 26th, also says a face covering should be used and continues. Social distancing practices should be used. Phased opening of buildings will continue. In-person events can occur following the governor's guidance. Gatherings of more than 50 people where social distancing protocols can occur. Travel will be permitted with supervisor's approval and following the governor's guidance. President Green's letter concludes, employees who are vulnerable or live with someone who is vulnerable should work with their supervisor or human resources to determine appropriate accommodations for each stage. The success of reopening our state and our university relies on the careful and deliberate actions of each of us. I am as eager as all of us to return to in-person interactions, but we need to be successful in keeping COVID-19 at bay while preparing for the events and activities of summer and the restart of in-person classes in the fall. I encourage each of you to continue to do your part, support each other, and most of all, keep yourselves and each other safe. Keep calm and vandal on. That from a letter to University of Idaho faculty and staff from University President C. Scott Green sent today. Idaho Governor Brad Little said the state will be sending checks to small businesses impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic shortly after the application period for the program starts Monday, April 11th. The state will spend $300 million of its $1.25 billion in federal Coronavirus CARES Act aid for the new Idaho Rebound Grants Program for small businesses. Businesses will be eligible for up to $10,000 each, Little said on an Idaho public television show last night. It is our goal to restart the economy. Some of that is taking place right now. He said the grants, quote, give them a cash infusion to allow them, A, to survive, and B, to be ready to go so we can continue to accelerate the economy. State officials say the grants are likely to go to 30,000 different businesses statewide, and the state will post the names of the recipients on the Transparency Idaho website. Businesses with 1 to 19 employees will be able to apply starting Monday, May 11th, and those with up to 50 employees will be allowed to apply in the second wave starting Monday, May 18th. Businesses must have had an active Idaho Tax Commission withholding account prior to January 1st to be eligible. Businesses will not be able to double dip, for example, get an Idaho Rebound grant if they have already received funds through the Federal Small Business Administration Disaster Loan Program or the Paycheck Protection Program. Governor Little's budget director, Alex Adams, told the Idaho Press the reason for this is, quote, the governor was really trying to focus on businesses who had fallen through the cracks of other federal programs. Also during the TV show, Little answered one question he was not able to answer during a press conference earlier in the day. A reporter had asked him if employees will lose their unemployment benefits if they don't want to go back to work at a business that has reopened under his Rebound Idaho phased approach because they're still concerned they could get coronavirus. Little said if they have any kind of immunological challenge, that's a legitimate issue, meaning they would be eligible for continued unemployment benefits. He said, but if they're just saying, yeah, well, I don't want to go back to work because I think it's dangerous and their employer needs them to go back to work, that's the line. Then if you're asked to go back to work, you need to go back to work. The Idaho COVID-19 Financial Advisory Committee voted unanimously this afternoon to spend $2 million in Federal CARES Act money on bulk state purchases of personal protective equipment for small businesses. The state has received $1.25 billion in Federal CARES Act aid. According to the Idaho Press, Idaho Department of Administration Director Keith Reynolds said at the teleconference meeting, for small businesses, what we call back-to-work supplies would be folded into the same program. We have a website that will be set up and active early this week that will work as an order request mechanism. Our biggest challenge right now is determining what that demand actually looks like. We have a good amount of supplies on order and will continue to adjust as we go forward. Governor Brad Little's budget director, Alex Adams, who is chair of the COVID-19 Financial Advisory Committee, said this is a recommendation from the governor's Economic Rebound Working Group. Three northern Idaho residents, including a Grangeville pastor, have filed a federal lawsuit against the Idaho Health Department, saying Governor Brad Little's social distancing orders violate their religious freedom. The lawsuit by Grangeville Christian Reformed Church pastor Michael Gulata Laclede Community Church pastor Josh Jones and churchgoer Scott Herndon of Sagal says the stay-at-home order is unconstitutional and specifically mentions limits on religious gatherings. Although Governor Little's order prohibiting gatherings of any type expired yesterday, his new Rebound Idaho plan still requires social distancing at religious gatherings. An attorney for the three plaintiffs told the Associated Press the remaining requirement that congregants socially distance themselves at religious gatherings is also unconstitutional. Attorney Nathan McPherson said to dictate that we may not worship by gathering together means we actually can't worship. Noting Governor Little's order banned non-essential businesses from operating, McPherson said, "How can something that is a fundamental constitutional right not be essential? It's just mind-blowing that a government official would make such a distinction." Governor Little issued his statewide stay-at-home order Wednesday, March 25th. It expired yesterday, and the governor has replaced it with a four-phase approach that would be implemented in two-week increments if there are no spikes in COVID-19 in the state. As of today, Johns Hopkins University's tally showed Idaho has had 2,000 confirmed coronavirus cases and 60 deaths. One of the first things Little mentioned when announcing the next phases was the end of the prohibition on religious gatherings starting today with social distancing. Despite that, some Northern Idaho churches will not start having services right away. Pastor Candy Moon of the Community of Christ Church in Coeur d'Alene told the Spokesman Review she has tentatively planned to ask congregants to return at the end of May, but she has not set a hard date yet. Moon said her church building is small and it's difficult to social distance. She said she could pick up the virus if she holds services too soon and then bring it home to where she cares for her 91-year-old mother. Republican State Representative Tim Remington, who is pastor of the Altar Church in Coeur d'Alene, held a service which violated Governor Little's stay-at-home order March 29th, and then his church board of directors told him to switch his services to online only. Remington claims any elected leaders who don't make an exception for religious services are committing constitutional misconduct. He said he plans to hold two services at his church Sunday, although ushers will help attendees social distance and make masks available. He said he believes only a few hundred of his congregation, which numbers more than 1,000, will show up, which will mean social distancing won't be a problem. There have been 62 confirmed COVID-19 cases in Kootenai County. In the five-county Panhandle Health District, there have been 66 confirmed cases, 5 hospitalizations, and 0 deaths. There have been 21 coronavirus deaths just across the state line from Kootenai County in Spokane County, Washington. Public Health Idaho North Central District reported 2 new deaths from COVID-19 in Nez Perce County yesterday, bringing the county's death total to 18. There are 51 confirmed coronavirus cases in Nez Perce County. The Daily News reports Latah County had no new confirmed cases yesterday, leaving Latah County's total number of cases at 5. The state of Idaho now has 2,015 confirmed cases of COVID-19 with 63 deaths. Whitman County reports 16 confirmed COVID-19 cases with no deaths and 625 negative tests to date. Assotin County reports 18 confirmed cases with 2 deaths. Washington State reports 14,327 confirmed COVID-19 cases with 814 deaths. The Moscow City Council yesterday voted unanimously to rescind their emergency orders closing non-essential businesses that cannot maintain social distancing. The orders, which have been in place since mid-March, would have expired next Tuesday anyway. The resolution essentially means Moscow residents should follow Governor Brad Little's four-phase Rebound Idaho plan to reopen the state's economy in two-week steps, providing there are no spikes in the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the state during each two-week segment. Moscow City Supervisor Gary Riedner listed the aspects of the first phase of Governor Little's plan and noted which parts are orders and which parts are advisories.
Section 3 of that order indicates that the following businesses within the state of Idaho are required to remain closed except to perform minimum basic operations as defined in a different section. Bars and nightclubs are to remain closed during this phase or this stage. Restaurant dining rooms, except takeout and delivery, will also remain closed. Indoor gyms and recreation facilities to remain closed. Close contact services is, for example, hair salons, nail salons, massage parlors, cosmetic, etc., will also remain closed. And large venues, for example, movie theaters, concert venues, sporting venues, etc. There are also some advisories. One is that public and private gatherings should be avoided. So that is something that is not as directory as it could be. There are some required and mandatory pieces here that business and governmental agencies may resume operations at physical locations except those businesses that I just defined. All businesses must adhere to social distancing and sanitation requirements as described in Section 7 of the order. That is required and mandatory. Those gatherings I just mentioned, public and private, continue to self-isolate. Those are guidelines, so there is no penalty affiliated with that. Non-essential travel should be avoided or minimized. Again, advisory. Individuals arriving from Idaho or in Idaho from another state or country are to be self-quarantined. That is required. Individuals shall maintain at least 6 feet physical distance from other individuals whenever possible. That is required and mandatory. However, the term whenever possible is open to some interpretation as well. Then the the guidelines about increased hygiene practices, washing, that sort of thing, washing your hands, stay home if sick, use face coverings. Masks are not mandatory under this order. And then they have some directory information for employers. Employers shall develop and implement measures to ensure employees and customers are maintaining 6 foot physical distancing. They'll provide adequate sanitation and personal hygiene for employees, vendors, and patrons, and will frequently disinfect commonly touched and high traffic areas and regularly clean those areas. Employers should, and these are advisory, identify personal use items such as a mask, face coverings, and gloves may be required by employees, vendors, and or patrons. Provide services while limiting close interactions with patrons. Identify strategies for addressing ill employees. On a case-by-case basis, include other practices appropriate for specific types of businesses, such as screening of employees for illness and exposures upon work entry, requiring non-cash transactions, etc., and implement additional protocols established in the governor's guidelines for opening up Idaho and the business-specific protocols published at rebound.idaho.gov that I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation.
That was Moscow City Supervisor Gary Riedner. City Councilmember Brandy Sullivan said the governor has a diverse group of people advising him on his plan, and she doesn't think the city can do any better. Sullivan also said local people should treat the advisory parts of Governor Little's plan as orders if they're going to succeed in keeping the pandemic down.
I don't think I can find any more valid information by looking on YouTube or looking on Facebook or talking to people about their opinions. And this is a very diverse group of people advising the governor. So I don't think we can do any better than that. And I feel it's appropriate to discontinue where we are right now. But I also think it's very important, probably the most important thing as we go forth with this gradual rollout, is that the protocol for the stages that should be followed every step of the way to ensure success moving forward are made very well known. That these are the things that Gary mentioned are not necessarily enforceable, but in my opinion, these are the things that if we all come together as employers and as citizens and as customers and do our best to follow these things, we can successfully move through these stages more likely than if we just choose to disregard them.
Sullivan also warned about the possibility the pandemic might return in the fall if people don't take social distancing measures.
And hearing from many people about, we've done so well here, can't we get going? And I understand that wanting to start opening up. And the great thing is that with this plan, we are. It's gradual. Feel like our finish line is in sight, and just to again repeat, please let's not blow it. We need everybody out there to do their part so that this can be a temporary situation. The end of this four stages that the governor has is the end of June. In some ways that's a long ways off, but it is close when you think about how it could go into the fall. And nobody wants that to happen. Everybody's sacrificed and been patient so far. I know everyone's starting to get impatient. These are 2-week increments. Just take it 2 weeks at a time. We can do this. Everybody's got to be on board and do their part so we can continue to move through.
That was Moscow City Councilmember Brandi Sullivan speaking remotely at last night's special council meeting. The American Civil Liberties Union of Idaho and the civil rights group Legal Voice have filed a motion in U.S. District Court in Idaho asking it to block the state from enforcing the new law that bans transgender women and girls from participating in women's college and school sports. The law, which Governor Brad Little signed at the end of March, is set to go into effect July 1st. The ACLU of Idaho and Legal Voice contend in their lawsuit, filed 2 weeks ago, that the new law is unconstitutional because it discriminates against transgender people. The ban would replace the current Idaho High School Activities Association policy that allows transgender women and girls to play on female teams after 1 year of hormone therapy. The NCAA has a similar policy. The law also allows unspecified persons to challenge a female athlete's eligibility if they suspect they are transgender and requires a signed statement from the student's personal physician that he or she has examined the student's physical anatomy, genetic makeup, or testosterone levels to determine they are not transgender. All of the legislature's Democrats opposed the bill, but the widespread support from the Republican majority led to its passage. Republican Representative Barbara Ehart of Idaho Falls sponsored the Fairness in Women's Sports Act. You're tuned to KRFP Moscow Pullman. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, and this is the KRFP Evening Report.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
KRFP Radio Free Moscow would like to thank all listeners who have made a tax-deductible donation to our progressive community radio station in this time of need. If you have never donated and were waiting for the right time, that time has come. KRFP has received a challenge grant of $500 specifically to raise funds from new donors. Individual memberships are $35 and family memberships are $50. Students and low-income listeners can become members for $20. Please donate today, and first-time donors will see their contributions matched through this challenge grant. Just go to carefp.org and pay via PayPal, or send a check to CareFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Be sure to note that you are a first-time donor, so we may double your donation.
KRFP, Moscow Pullman.
And this is the KRFP Evening Report. Officials at the Tyson Fresh Meats beef plant near Walla Walla said yesterday the facility will remain closed until health officials receive coronavirus test results on its 1,400 employees. According to the Tri-City Herald, Walla Walla County health officials said Wednesday the results are still pending and, quote, once the test results are received, positive cases will be handled by the county in which the employee resides. Tyson Fresh Meats officials temporarily closed the plant Friday of last week following more than 100 positive test results among the plant's workers. A 60-year-old butcher from the Tri-Cities who worked at the plant died of coronavirus. As of yesterday, tests have confirmed 130 people linked to the plant tested positive for COVID-19. That number includes employees and non-employees. Most people with positive test results live in the Tri-Cities area, with 120 living in Benton or Franklin counties, 9 in Walla Walla County, and 1 person living in Umatilla County, Oregon. The company said last week it would pay its employees during the temporary shutdown. Idaho residents filed 8,827 new unemployment claims last week, bringing the state's total active claims to 117,811. According to the Idaho Department of Labor, the number is twice the amount of initial unemployment claims filed by Idahoans in 2019. Data from the Labor Department shows the state paid $45 million in unemployment benefits from March 23rd through April 25th. The figure does not include the $600 weekly payment through the Federal Pandemic Unemployment Compensation Program, which started last Friday. The Lewiston Tribune reports Washingtonians filed 137,605 initial unemployment claims last week, bringing the state's total claims to over 1.4 million. The number also reflects people who have filed multiple claims seeking retroactive compensation. According to Washington Employment Security Department Commissioner Susie Levine, Washington paid over $988 million in unemployment benefits last week. Levine said that was, quote, by far the largest week of unemployment benefits delivered in our state's history. We had more initial claims in the past 7 weeks than we've had in the past 3.5 years combined. Levine said Washington has paid out $1.5 billion in benefits to date, with around $1 billion of the money coming from the Federal Economic Rescue Package, which contains the additional $600 weekly unemployment benefit and extends benefits 13 weeks beyond the 26 weeks Washington offers. She said she expects unemployment claims in the state to continue to rise because of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Over 30 million Americans have now filed for unemployment benefits due to the pandemic. Spokane police made homeless people who had pitched brand new tents in a tent city in a Spokane city park yesterday leave the park. Spokane police said they did not arrest anyone last night at Spokane's Coeur d'Alene Park in the Browns Addition neighborhood as they cleared the park, telling those who had set up tents to go to area warming centers and homeless shelters. According to a police news release, just before 5 p.m. yesterday, police said they planned to surround the park. Spokane Police Captain Tracy Meidel used her police vehicle public address system to tell those who were in the park at the time camping is illegal there. Meidel also said transportation would be provided to area shelters. According to the spokesman review, when the residents began setting up tents, After Jules Helping Hands, the nonprofit operating the nearby Cannon Street Warming Center, gave them, the city decided to take action. Jules Helping Hands had been operating the Cannon Street Warming Center for the past year, and they have refused to make way for a new operator after the city closed the center. The city gave Jules Helping Hands permission to reopen the Cannon Street Warming Center for one night last night. The center closed at 10 a.m. this morning. Daniel Rose, who told the paper he has been homeless for the past 2 years, said the closure of the Jules Helping Hands facility was abrupt and devastating to him and many other homeless people. Rose said there were many calls for people to resist and described the scene as chaotic. He said, "There still has to be a place for us to go. Once we know something for sure, of course we'll take that option." Jules Helping Hands founder Julia Garcia said, "They had planned to exercise their contractual right to remove their property from the building before giving the keys to another operator." Garcia said, "This is insane. This is really so unbelievably insane. We're not trying to occupy the building or get the city to pay us. We just need to get our things." Jules gave out 120 tents to its patrons Thursday morning. City of Spokane spokesperson Brian Coddington acknowledged Jules Helping Hands has the right to remain at the site, just not as a shelter. Coddington said Jules has served their clients and their guests well. "It's unfortunate that for the next 14 days we're not going to be able to continue that service on behalf of their guests." Coddington said although the city had expected to close the warming center, they were caught off guard by the fallout from their actions, and they quickly worked to reopen the warming center under a new operator, the Guardians Foundation. Garcia said Jules doesn't have an issue with the closure of the Cannon Street Warming Center. "It's just people have no place to go." Garcia said, "I don't want to run a permanent shelter with the city of Spokane. That's not the issue. Jules, as an organization, is never okay with people sleeping outside." The Spokane Police Department fired Officer Christopher Henderson Tuesday for kicking 23-year-old Anthony Belcourt in the genitals while Belcourt was handcuffed by police during a July 2019 arrest. Police pursued 23-year-old Anthony Belcourt to his Spokane home last July, where court records say Belcourt left his vehicle in the middle of the road and ran into the house while cursing and insulting officers. Belcourt left his home without a weapon 3 minutes later, and police records say he lay on his stomach and put his hands behind his back. Police body camera footage obtained by the Spokesman Review through a public records request shows Officer Henderson, who had just arrived, kicking Belcourt's genitals as officers tried for a second time to raise the flailing man to his feet. Henderson is heard saying, "There you go," followed by a profanity. Police charged Belcourt with reckless driving, obstructing police, resisting arrest, and assaulting an officer. He had no prior criminal record. The Spokesman Review reports it obtained a letter through a records request by Spokane County Senior Prosecutor Mark Cipolla, who wrote, "In September, when Henderson kicked the handcuffed Belcourt in the groin, he did it intentionally and to be retaliatory rather than to protect himself and others." Cipolla wrote in the letter, "His decision to not pursue assault charges against Henderson was due to Belcourt's request that no charges be pressed." The Spokane Police Department continued its internal investigation following Cipolla's decision to not press assault charges against Henderson. Previously in July, Spokane Police Department internal affairs investigators said Henderson's kick appeared to violate department policy, and the department placed him on administrative leave. Henderson told investigators he tried to tie-kick Belcourt to knock him off balance because Belcourt had donkey-kicked another officer. He said Belcourt was flailing around and he was trying to protect other officers. According to court documents, Henderson said he was kicked once in the shin by Belcourt. According to video footage, Henderson reported kicking Belcourt in the genitals to a Spokane police lieutenant at the scene. He later told investigators striking a handcuffed suspect is, quote, an exceptional technique, unquote, but he felt it was reasonable under the circumstances. Spokane police ended the internal investigation of the matter in November after Spokane Police Ombudsman Bart Logue certified it. A panel of Spokane Police Department officials reviewed the investigation's findings and made recommendations to Spokane Police Chief Craig Meidel to use in his final decision in the case. Meidel chose to fire Henderson. A news release from the department said that investigation determined Henderson had violated Spokane Police Department policy and his employment was terminated. Henderson's attorney, Rocky Trepiedi, said Henderson was disappointed in the decision. Trepiedi said the Spokane Police Guild has offered Henderson a grievance process with the city and he hopes to be reinstated through the process. He told the spokesman review of Henderson's case is not resolved through the grievance process. Independent arbitration between the city of Spokane and the police guild would be the next step. A hunter in Idaho County found the remains of a man about 1 mile from the mouth of Bernard Creek, southwest of Riggin Sunday. Authorities believe the remains are those of Todd W. Hofflander of Lucille, who disappeared while hiking with his dog in the Seven Devils area 10 years ago. Hofflander was 39 when someone reported him missing in September 2010. According to a post on the Idaho County Sheriff's Facebook page, the hunter found the remains near Hofflander's last known location, and deputies suspect they are his. The hunter also found a backpack with a digital camera and camping equipment. The Lewiston Tribune reports a jet boat transported 8 sheriff's office personnel to the site to recover the remains. The sheriff's office Facebook post said, everything found at the scene indicates these are the remains of Mr. Hofflander. However, further testing will be done. Hofflander's family has been notified and the remains will be sent to the Ada County Coroner's Office for DNA testing. Hofflander's dog, Ruby, was found by someone shortly after Hofflander went missing on the opposite side of the ridge from where he was last seen. A Lewiston woman made her first court appearance in Nez Perce County Court yesterday after police arrested her Wednesday on felony domestic battery charges following a knife-throwing and stabbing incident with her husband. According to the Lewiston Tribune, court documents say 30-year-old Amanda R. Haynes was arrested Wednesday night on the 200 block of Wheatlands Avenue near Lewiston. According to a probable cause affidavit, following an argument with her husband, Haynes said she felt threatened by him. Haynes allegedly stabbed her husband after throwing a knife at him. Police say the stab wound was about an inch deep. The husband said Haynes was actually threatening to harm herself before she threw the knife. Also, the affidavit says some of the event was recorded on both parties' cell phones. The couple's child was not at home when the incident occurred. According to the affidavit, Haynes spent one night in jail and jailers released her yesterday. A judge has issued a no-contact order.
KRFP Community Radio is proudly supported by Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals since 2006.
KRFP, Moscow, Idaho.
Please stay tuned for a public service announcement to reduce the spread of the novel coronavirus. Please be aware of the following symptoms: fever, sore throat, dry cough, nausea, diarrhea, and difficulty breathing. If you or anyone that you have been in close contact with are experiencing these symptoms, contact your healthcare professional and self-quarantine as soon as possible. Visit cdc.gov/coronavirus. We hope that you stay well.
And you're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report, special extended edition for Friday, May 1st. Later in the Evening Report, we'll have an interview with Latah County Commissioner Tom Lamar. And right now, we have Governor Jay Inslee's press conference held today at the state capitol announcing that he is extending his stay-at-home order and banning of non-essential travel until May 31st. This press conference lasts about 49 minutes.
Ready? Good afternoon. Today I'm pleased to say that we are starting our careful, phased, science and data-driven process to reopen Washington's economy while we are remaining absolutely steadfast in our commitment to the health of Washingtonians. On Monday, I will issue a new extension of our stay home, stay healthy order. And this will allow us to take some initial immediate steps to begin reopening. We're turning the dial. Washington businesses will reopen in four phases, which I'll discuss today. And in addition, several smaller counties that have not been hit so hard by COVID-19 will be able to apply to the Department of Health for a variance from my order so that they can continue open some of their operations. But I've got to just at the outset recognize something that all of we Washingtonians have to realize, and that we have not won this fight against this virus. Monday's order will continue a ban on public gatherings. Many businesses will have to remain closed. And that is why I'm extending the order through May 31st. I would like to tell you that we would all be able to make reservations on June 1st, but I cannot. We will have to continue to monitor and to assess the data on a daily basis and adapt as conditions allow. Immediate steps to begin reopening. We're turning the dial. Washington businesses will reopen in four phases, which I'll discuss today. And in addition, several smaller counties that have not been hit so hard by COVID-19 will be able to apply to the Department of Health for a variance from my order so that they can continue open some of their operations. But I've got to just at the outset recognize something that all of we Washingtonians have to realize, and that we have not won this fight against this virus. Monday's order will continue a ban on public gatherings. Many businesses will have to remain closed. And that is why I'm extending the order through May 31st. I would like to tell you that we would all be able to make reservations on June 1st, but I cannot. We will have to continue to monitor and to assess the data on a daily basis and adapt as conditions allow. So the new normal is not here yet, but I'd like to share some good news. And then a consideration. This morning I met with the Department of Health team, who've been doing a crackerjack job, and modelers from the Institute for Disease Modeling. This morning they told me that there is continuing evidence that we are suppressing the spread of COVID-19. Transmission rates in central Puget Sound are down. What we're doing is working. Social distancing is working. But the stark answer to the question of lifting restrictions was summarized well in the final graph of the presentation I saw. And the headline there was, cautious, well-informed relaxation will be critical. Why don't you leave that one up there just a minute, Sam? Let's go back to the other slide. I want to show you what this slide means. If you look at this slide from the Institute, what it shows is that the infections have peaked at a certain level. This is for King County. This is just a representative sample of one of our great counties. You'll notice that the black dots represent data points that we've experienced, and the red dots are what we've experienced just for the last couple of weeks. What we have seen is that there appears to be a reduction in the rates of infection, or the R-naught number, you've heard about that, in King County. That's good news. But if you look at the gray line on this chart, that gray line, as it starts to go up, represents what would happen to us if we abandon our social distancing efforts today. That is a dangerous increase in fatalities. We cannot allow that to happen. We have to remain committed to make wise decisions. And I think this is one we're making today. So we're laying out a course in this regard to make good data-based decisions of reopening at the right pace. Now, before we get in details of this order, I would like to address the families of over 800 Washingtonians who have lost their lives to this virus. I just want you to know this. You and your loved one will never be a number to us. You're going to be someone that our hearts are with. And the memories will not be washed away by the numbers on the graphs we talk about, because every one of these losses leave the holes in the hearts of their loved ones. And as we go forward and make these very difficult decisions, I hope people will share that view that I have about these families. Now, some people have argued that this threat is exaggerated, that the death rate doesn't warrant a vigorous response. And to those people, I ask to consider for one moment what it is like to lose a loved one to this vicious and somewhat mysterious killer. 6 months ago, we didn't know anything about this virus. But as of this week, as many people have died in the United States as all of the U.S. soldiers we lost in 8 years of combat in Vietnam. We are not wrestling with whether to lean toward the economy or to public health. They are one. They are mutually dependent. As economist Justin Wolfers put it Thursday, there is no economic health without public health. So I'd like to share with you to show how we're going to carefully recover. I'm joined today by Department of Health Secretary John Weissman, as well as Vice Admiral Dr. Raquel Bono, the director of our state's COVID-19 healthcare response, and they will be available for questions a little later. So there are four phases to our plan. We'll start with phase one. This chart basically, this will be available for your review, of course, showing the four phases of our economic recovery plan. Phase one is essentially where we are today with some minor changes. And every subsequent phase will obviously require social distancing going forward and appropriate health precautions, including the use of personal protective equipment in a number of industries that are affected. And this includes modifications we have made in the last week around construction activities and selected outdoor activities, such as fishing, hunting, and access to parks. So we are now and will be working with the industries to have protocols available to them by mid-May that will allow retail curbside pickup operations, automobile sales, and car washes. These will be with restrictions. This would allow also drive-in spiritual services with one household per vehicle. And more outdoor activities will start next week. But I do want to reiterate this, and this is a theme of going forward for the next several months. We still have a ban on large gatherings, even gatherings where participants might think they can socially distance. And our office has received several reports of individuals engaged in large outdoor activities and events that are just too dangerous. And I just want to say at this outset, we are now moving forward to another phase of this mission for the state of Washington. And it is even more important now about the individual commitment of Washingtonians to help their community thrive. And it's the individual decisions that all of us will be making in the next weeks and months to come that is really going to determine whether we succeed to prevent huge fatalities in our state. I feel confident about that because Washingtonians have been doing a great job already. But we're going to need to keep it up for some period of time. So phase two will allow additional expansions of outdoor recreation activities that are not allowed in phase one, including camping. Small gatherings of five people socially or less could return. I know that will be welcome. As well as new construction and in-store retail purchases. All of these, of course, with appropriate health restrictions. Barbershops and salons will then be able to reopen. Restaurants will reopen with 50% capacity and a table size no larger than five. Some professional services and offices could open as well, even though telemarketing will remain strongly encouraged. Pet care services, including grooming, could resume. And again, individuals and businesses would still need to follow all of the safety and health guidelines that we will work with industries and business leaders and working people to make sure we do this in a smart, safe, and healthy way. So phase three. This would expand more gatherings to 50 people or less, including sports activities, and would resume non-essential travel. Restaurants would move up to 75% capacity, and bars at 25% capacity. Gyms and movie theaters could reopen at 50% capacity. Retail, libraries, museums, and government buildings will reopen. Recreational facilities like pools could open at 50% capacity. Nightclubs and entertainment venues will need to wait for the next phase, which is, of course, phase four. So phase four is going to involve resuming the majority of public interactions. Gatherings of more than 50 people will be allowed, but still while practicing social distancing. Now, I have said that our return to normal will still not look the way they did before this virus hit us until we have pharmaceutical interventions such as a vaccine. No one knows when that is going to happen. But it would mean bars, restaurants, and entertainment venues could return to allow the maximum license capacity of their venues. And we could resume unrestricted staffing of work sites, with the exception, again, with physical distancing should remain in place. I also want to note that while we're going through these phases, cities and county jurisdictions by law can take more strict, they can put in place more strict restrictions for their jurisdictions, even more restrictive than those in our state Stay Home and Stay Healthy initiative. And that is up to their local decision making for the public needs and local conditions. Now, I'd like to describe the conditions that will guide us when we decide when it is right to move from one phase to another. The data on public health information will determine when we move from one phase to another. And so I'd like to discuss those dials, if I may. What you see before you is a selection of what we call the dials that will judge when we can make these decisions. The first dial basically is the infection disease status itself, and that is obviously the most important of the metrics that we will look at. And under that metric, we have numerous pieces of information. We make our decisions based on dozens of data points in determining the status of the virus. We look at, just for instance, we look at the hospital rates of hospitalization per day with people with COVID-like illness. We look at the deaths per day, obviously. We look at the long-term care facilities and how they've been impacted with COVID. We look at the models, just one of which I showed you today. We look at several models that project where we're going in the immediate future. We look at the percentage of positive tests. And just on, I just wanted to show you, just to get a flavor of the wealth of data we have, the chart we have up on the screen right now is a screenshot of 12 graphs amongst many that we look at. And these are all available on our website to look at the specific data. Second thing we look at, and of course I'm looking at, if I can see this, if you can bring this closer, Sam, because, here we go. We got this right behind me, I think, or we'll have in just a moment. The second is the testing capacity and availability. Now, this is critical to our efforts because we are making a shift in strategies. We're moving from the dull instrument of social distancing as our primary weapon against this virus to depending on testing capacity to find people who are affected by this virus and then move to find a way to take care of them and to isolate them. And central to that is our testing capability. As you know, this has been way more limited than we would want. We have been limited to be doing maybe 4,000 tests a day. We want to get several times that to be able to make sure everyone who needs a test can get a test very quickly. We hope that that will ramp up shortly. We have been promised, for instance, 1 million swabs that are used in this test by the federal government. We hope that that promise will be fulfilled so we can increase our testing. But that dial needs to be much higher than it is today for us to be able to move into the next phase of this battle. The next dial we look at is our case and contact investigation capability. After we test for a person, we'll need to investigate their contacts to see if people they have contacted need a test and make sure that we isolate the people that, in fact, are tested positive so they do not transmit the disease. And this is going to take a small army to do all this work. It's very labor-intensive because we have today about 200 infections a day that we have to be able to trace all the people they met. So we have to get that army built up. It is our intention to have about 1,500 people by mid-May involved in that in the state of Washington. The third issue is our risk to vulnerable populations. We need to be attentive that we're caring for those who are most vulnerable in our long-term care facilities, our working people that work in very difficult situations. That has led to some inequities in the distribution of this disease. We need to be addressing those inequities to protect all of our people, not just some. And the last dial is our healthcare system readiness. We have to make sure that our healthcare is ready for the job in the event that we saw an increase in this disease. And that includes the need to have PPE, personal protection equipment, not just for our healthcare workers, for people in many industries that are today working in difficult circumstances. So we will be looking at all of these metrics and making a judgment on a regular basis to determine whether we can move to the next phase. It will be based on numbers, metrics, and the scope of this virus and how far we have turned these dials. Now, none of these dials are in the safety zone right now. All of them will have to be significantly improved in the next month or so and going forward as well. So we'll have 3 weeks at least between phases also to allow us to evaluate whether what we've done has worked or not or whether it's increased a danger. So that is the minimum time period before phases. And it may be much more than 3 weeks given the nature of this disease. I also want to say that we have all been mindful of the regional differences and impacts that we've seen across the state with regard to the COVID-19 and our response. We know that not every part of our state has been hit equally hard by this disease. Therefore, some counties with lower numbers of cases and deaths, as well as if they have enough PPE and hospital capacity, We're going to allow them to explore possibilities moving sooner to phase two. The 10 counties that would be eligible have extremely low number of cases, and their combined populations represent less than 3% of our state. So these are the counties that will be able to move sooner given certain conditions. Columbia, Garfield, Jefferson, Lincoln, Ponderay, Skamania, Wakayakum, Kittitas, Ferry, and Grays Harbor. So if these counties, in partnership with their local health jurisdictions, can find ways to open up certain sectors that prove effective, then they can move earlier to the next phase, to phase two. And what we learn from those counties can help larger counties learn as well. So these counties will have a high bar to meet, but if they can get there, they can go forward with local plans. In the next 2 weeks, the Department of Health and my office will consider additional criteria that could potentially allow other counties to apply for a variance. So we're going to continue to look at the data as we have. We're going to make adjustments accordingly. We're going to monitor and adapt. We're going to be agile and aggressive against this virus. Again, all of the metrics we rely on are available to the public. Our COVID-19 risk assessment dashboard, you can find at coronavirus.wa.gov, coronavirus.wa.gov. I think that's important because virtually everything we look at is available to the public. We want to be totally transparent with you as we make these very difficult decisions for our state. So we know that reopening areas with more densely populated areas will be more difficult. So we're going to continue to monitor these matters. I just want to head to some closing comments by saying that it's gratifying, and we have a lot to be proud of in Washington. Washingtonians have been hugely committed to the Stay Home, Stay Healthy initiative. And as a result of that, Washingtonians have allowed us to have this early success. But this remains a very precarious situation. And we cannot be lulled into some sense of relief or thinking that we're out of the woods. We're sort of like that mistaken skydiver who jumped out of the airplane with his parachute, and the parachute worked really, really well, and it slowed the rate of his descent. And he was so happy about it, the success of that parachute, that he thought he could just cut the straps and things would turn out okay. Well, we have been successful to date in slowing the progress of this disease. But if we cut the straps right now, we're going to have a really, really bad result hitting the ground. Because the epidemiologists tell us very clearly, this is just going to jump right back up and bite us if we do not continue efforts that are significant and aggressive in our state. I know there's many aspects to this crisis, and its disruptions have taken a toll on mental health as well. And I do want you to know, if you feel alone in this struggle, I hope you'll think and thinking about it that you're not. And I want you to help yourself if you need that, or your loved ones. Go to coronavirus.wa.gov. There's a way to seek some help if you're having some challenges bearing up under this stress. Don't be shy about that. This is a tough thing we're going through. But we want you to take care of yourself. Just don't wash your hands. Take care of how you're feeling, too. Lastly, if you're looking for a way to support our essential workers, you can participate in Lieutenant Governor Cyrus Habib's Washington Mask Challenge. If you have homemade cloth masks to donate to an organization in need, we'd encourage you to go to www.wamaskchallenge.org. www.wamaskchallenge.org, and the Lieutenant Governor's Office will connect you with the organization closest to you. And if you're one of those organizations in need of cloth masks, please connect with the Lieutenant Governor, who's shown real leadership in this regard. So with that, I'll be very happy to stand for your questions.
First question goes to Rachel with AP.
Governor, related to the testing, as we talk about moving into these phases, is there a specific daily number the state thinks needs to be done before you're comfortable for us to move into the next phase? And then as it relates to the smaller counties, can you give a few more specifics about this process that they have to kind of go through to get a waiver, and the earliest that that might happen?
Yes. The testing, I wish I'd give you just one simple number, but the honest answer is it's going to vary depending on the status of the disease when we get to the place to really make these decisions about when to move these phases. Right now, the situation is we can do about 4,000 tests a day with the very limited number of test kits we have. We have analytical capability. We have enough analysis machines to do about 20,000 tests a day. I can tell you today, I certainly would like to be able to do 20,000 tests today and have the test kits to be able to do that. There's a fair chance we will be able to get there in the next month or so, or even earlier than that, if the federal government fulfills its commitment to us to get us a million test kits that they said that they will provide us fairly shortly. That's certainly a level I think we would need to be in the short term. However, that number will increase as we move forward throughout these steps, and that's counterintuitive. You think as things got better, you'd need less tests. In fact, we need more. Because as people return to work, we are going to want to test them, many of them, particularly if there's any indication of the virus in a company. We're going to want to test people all around that individual. And there's no reason to not do that except the lack of testing capacity. So the need will grow significantly above that 20,000 over time. And the amount we end up needing will depend on the extent of the virus and how fast we can bring people back. Your second question, Rachel, I got to start writing these down. The criteria for the counties. So the process will be that the local health department will need to make a decision whether they would like to move to the next stage, stage two. If they decide they would like to do that, they'll forward the recommendation to the county commissioners, and the county commissioners then will make a decision whether they would like to move to stage two. They will submit some plans to the Department of Health. They'll need to show that they have a good surge capacity in the hospitals and have good PPE, and if those things are in place, then those 10 counties will be able to move forward.
Next question comes from Drew with King 5.
Good afternoon, Governor. As you know, and you may be able to hear behind me, there are folks who are still upset, and this news is not going to be good for them. They want to get back to work. They want these orders lifted. And while there may be some things peeled back here in a couple of weeks, realistically, we're talking about June before getting into to barbershops or any kind of restaurants. Are you worried about the fatigue turning into more of an ignoring of the order, and do you expect to have to raise the enforcement level, be it the National Guard or local police?
No, look, the vast majority of Washingtonians don't want to see their relatives die of the COVID virus. The vast number of Washingtonians accept that this is a community interest that we have and we're all working together. And the vast majority of Washingtonians understand that if we stick together for a while longer, we won't lose all the gains that we've already made. And they understand that this has been painful. Look, I understand the frustrations that we all have shared. It's so frustrating that we don't want to do this twice. This is bad enough once. We should not take the risk to do this twice. And we have to make decisions based on hard-headed data and science and not wishes when it comes to life itself. And the hard-headed science tells us that we've got one decision to make here if we're going to continue on the road to recovery. And that's doing what we're doing. Make a cautious return of our businesses that we have set forth. We have already allowed the reopening of construction and hunting and golf. We've allowed the reopening of elective surgery. We're moving forward with some restricted matters as soon as in the next couple of weeks so that we can move forward on those protocols that we had. So we are making progress. We are opening businesses today. And this is a very rational approach moving forward. And that's how we have to make decisions.
Next question Next question comes from Jim with the Spokesman Review.
Governor, if other counties other than the 10 that you mentioned show lower rates, will it be possible for their health officers and their county commissioners to ask to move forward faster on the phases? And do you have some criteria that you would put forward for them?
Well, yes, the 10 that were accepting a request, should they want to make it, are extremely low rates of infection that are quite unique. They're also relatively small counties, and that was important as well, so that we don't want to take risks if something goes wrong. We're going to use them as barometers as to how this works, actually. And as I've said, in a couple weeks, we'll evaluate this to see whether it makes sense to allow further requests from other counties as well. And again, we'll be driven by data to see what the situation looks like at that time. But I do want to note that these 10 counties are quite different from others in several respects.
Next question comes from Simone with Q13.
Hi, Governor. How long do you anticipate it would take for a county to go through the process of applying for this waiver? And adding on to that one question, we're seeing in California, a county specifically has defined the governor's order there today, allowing schools, businesses, and churches to reopen. Some other cities are deciding to take legal action. If a county does not get approved or does not decide to wait for the DOH approval and goes ahead with reopening, what are the repercussions at the state level? And then just a clarification, does phase one begin next week, or is the school to be fully at the end of May?
Yes. On your first question, as far as the timeline, this is something, as soon as we hear from the counties, it's just a matter of days to turn around time to get an answer back to them. I actually think that these counties will find broad acceptance by the Department of Health because we've already sort of pre-screened them, if you will. So I don't think that's going to be a long period at all. As far as stage one, what we said is that the businesses we talked about being in stage one today, the new businesses, will essentially, we just need protocols so that they can return safely. And we want to do with them what we did with the construction industry, very successfully working with business leaders or builders and the laborers. And that should be done by May 15th. And I don't see any reason that it would not be.
Next question comes from Jim Drew with the News Tribune.
Governor, I was wondering if you could just help with the.
Jim, I need to repeat it.
Jim, can you repeat? We didn't hear you.
Sure. Governor, I was wondering if you could just kind of outline the calendar. You're talking about 3 weeks between phases. Does this essentially take us to mid-July in terms of the order or your proclamation being in effect?
You know, I'm really sorry. I had to talk to my pal here for a second. Could you repeat that?
Sure. In terms of the calendar, you said that you expect to see at least 3 weeks between phases. And I was wondering if you anticipate, because of that, having to extend this beyond May 31st, because it looks like 3 weeks between phases would take us to mid-July.
Well, I think if you do the math, it tends to get to that for the essentially, you know, large gatherings to move all the restrictions on gatherings of 50,000 people. That's a realistic assessment. Now, there's a possibility that, you know, we catch some massive break, that the virus, you know, goes downhill rapidly because of climatic conditions, or there is a cure that is found. You know, those things are possible, but I certainly don't believe we can count on those things. What we can count on is that if we do smart things, if we do the contact tracing and the isolation, there is really good reason to believe that it can be effective. If you look at other countries, South Korea, Taiwan, that had very, very aggressive testing and contact tracing and isolation strategies, They were able to do great things, and we want to be equally aggressive. So we ought to have confidence those things are going to work.
Next question comes from Keith with Tama.
Governor, you've got a long list of businesses and activities and a timeline that stretches way out into the summer. What if people jump the gun and they want to start opening now and they defy your order? You hear them outside right now. What are you going to do if there's a mass uprising against this?
Well, that just hasn't happened. And, you know, the great members of the press keep wishing for failure here, but that's not how we operate in Washington. We look for success, and that's what we're experiencing. We've had the greatest unification of Washingtonians that I've ever seen. I'm 69 years of age, and I've never seen this state so united. Republicans and Democrats, huge majorities want to see us to continue on this effort. Huge majorities are honoring this effort. We have not had to resort to legal action or criminality virtually at all. The only case we've had to file was against a landlord who tried to evict people against our moratorium on evictions for rent. That is an incredible achievement, and it's because of Washingtonians' success that of honoring this order that we've been able to bend the curve down. Look, I get calls from governors quite often saying, how have you been so successful? And I tell them it's because Washingtonians are smart enough and dedicated enough to be willing to make some sacrifices on a temporary basis to get this thing behind us as much as we possibly can and not have to go through this again. So I just do not want to bet on failure here. It's not happening. It hasn't happened. I don't believe it will happen, in part because we're showing Washingtonians that we want to have a phased approach to reopen this state. We've reopened significant businesses already, as I've announced today, and we have set forth a very good phased approach to reopen the entire economy in a way that's safe and gives people the hope that they need. So I feel good about the course we're on. It's a difficult time, but it is a very united time.
Next question comes from Joe with the Seattle Times.
Two-part question. The MLS announced that they would allow some sports training facilities to open back up. I'm curious if where local sports training facilities fit into your four-phase plan, and then also curious to hear broadly about your reaction to Amazon's decision to allow some workers to work from home through October 2nd. Do you think other businesses that can allow that function for their workers should adopt a guideline like that?
Well, I we're not mandating that, but we certainly encourage it. I think we have found broadly that telecommunications has worked for us. It certainly is working in our office where we're doing the vast majority of our work using electronics. And I think a lot of organizations, business and otherwise, have now found out these possibilities. I suspect that when we get over COVID, we're not going to get over, all of our electronics because we found they're very successful and we avoid laborious commutes on clogged highways. And so I think we have found this is working and we'd certainly encourage it. And I want to thank the enlightened business leadership in our state. I think one of the reasons we've been successful in our state because business leaders understood telecommuting early and helped adopt it early. It's been one of the reasons we succeeded. Your first question about athletic events. So in phase two, we essentially allow outdoor gatherings of over five, so that it could include training facilities. And we go to a 50 capacity in phase three and then unlimited in phase four. So this would allow, smaller groups in phase two and a little larger groups in phase three. From what I hear, it would probably allow what you're talking about in phase three. Thank you.
I don't know if John or Rocky has anything they want to add on the phone.
John or Rocky, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think you said it well, Governor. We're obviously in all of these phases needing to remember that keeping our physical distance is going to be really important. The virus is still going to be out there. We know that people can have it without symptoms. And so we need to do this to stay healthy and keep us all safe. So we'll be, as the governor said, gradually increasing the size of folks so that we reduce the number of contacts we have. We know that's incredibly important to our success, and we think Washingtonians understand that.
question comes from Austin with Northwest News Network.
Hello, Governor. Just a technicality, with the as the phases go into effect, would you allow those smaller counties to, again, with the variance, skip to the next phase? And then more broadly, I'm wondering, again, trying to do the calendar work on this, if by mid-May phase one is sort of fully implemented, is it reasonable to think if you're a restaurant owner or a retailer or maybe you have a hair salon that by June 1st you could be reopening with this new guidance, assuming you haven't seen a flare-up of cases? And I'm also just wondering about masking requirements and temperature checks, if you're going to get that specific at some point.
Well, yeah, if you look at our phase two, potentially, which would allow restaurants at 50% capacity and a whole slew of safety protocols that we will be working with the industry to adopt, that is a possibility. After three weeks. So you're really looking at in deeper in June after the completion of phase one. So, but this depends on the course of the virus. So these things are what I would suggest is, you know, hope for the best and prepare for everything. And we'll be working with the industry now to get those protocols in place so that they can move forward as the matter matures.
We have time for two more questions. The next one comes from Hannah Scott with Cairo Radio.
Hi, Governor. Two parts. Wanted to ask you, again, kind of following up on the restaurant industry, wondering if you've been at all in discussions with them about this plan regarding the capacity, which seems to vary between 25 and 75% at different phases, and whether or not that's something that they'll even be able to survive on and their employees be able to earn like they used to. Also curious, based on what you know today, what your confidence level is on schools, in-person school, resuming in the fall.
Well, I think there's a very good chance schools will reopen in the fall, and I'm very hopeful that is the case. What we do in the next several weeks will have a large impact on that decision. I think if Washingtonians abide by this phased approach, we will both reopen our economy, and we will make it much more likely that we can return to school in the fall. I think there's a good probability, I would say, that we will achieve those things, in part because this phased approach does recognize both the economic circumstances of our state and the need not to have more fatalities and not to have children, infected, so we'd have to close many, many schools. Now, this is also important that we ramp up the testing capability. You'll notice that is one of our very important dials. And having that dial turn so that it is in the safe zone is extremely important for our ability to open up schools, because in the event there is an infection in a school, to get enough confidence to reopen it or keep it open, we've got to have the ability to test large numbers of people to give people confidence very quickly. So that testing capability is fundamental to not only our reopening our businesses, but reopening our schools as well. As far as the ability, we've talked to various folks, and I think there's good reason to believe that at 50% capacity, when you look at restaurants, many remain operating at about 50%. We hope that they will be successful, and we will watch this situation. I was talking to the CEO of Starbucks the other day, and they said that their kind of mantra going forward is monitor and adapt. And I really think that that's the right course for all of us. We are going to look at the impact of these decisions and adapt if they're not working. And that's what we're doing right now. We're adapting. We've found we've been able to open up construction. We were able to open up fishing and golf. We're able to do elective surgery. We have adapted. And we're continuing to adapt in this phase one actions moving forward with automobile sales and car washes and the like. So we are adapting today. So we'll look at how this works for restaurant owners, and we hope that it's going to succeed. That's what we're aiming for.
Final question comes from Joey with the Everett Herald.
Governor, Here in Snohomish County, we've sort of seen a new baseline in our new cases each day at about 30, down from 100 a month ago. And as you've said, people overwhelmingly are complying with your stay-home order. I guess my question is, as you sort of start to reopen things, as people are eager to get back out, what is the, you know, trigger kind of like, some of our local health officials are worried about having to resume some restrictions if people get a little overly eager when they go back outside? So what kind of does that trigger look like to bring sort of restrictions back?
Well, if we can put up the dials again, if I can just look at these. I'm just going to read this chart. You may not be able to read them, all these, but if we can just look at these together. These are the metrics that we need to meet in order to avoid the problem that your local health officials are concerned about. It's a legitimate concern. And that's why we have set up metrics-based decision-making to make sure that we don't abandon success and then just have this virus come back and bite us again. The first thing is we look at the metrics of COVID-19 disease activities. So we need low and falling disease burdens. We measure that by COVID-19 cases, by number, the hospitalizations per day of COVID. We look at the rates of COVID-19 spread throughout Washington, what you call the R-naught number, which we evaluate very carefully. We look at modeling data from the Institute for Disease Modeling, the Institute for Health Metrics Evaluation, one from MIT, a fellow named Yu-Yun Gu. We also look at the physical distancing trends in the state. Are people complying with the order? Is this working to reduce the interactions? So those are just the first metrics we look at. Then we look at the testing capacity. We look at the number of tests we can perform each day. And we look at the speed by which we can get the results back to the affected family. Then we look at case and contact investigations. And essentially, we look at the number of investigators who are trained and ready to go to work. We look at the availability of isolation and quarantine units in case somebody needs to be isolated. What are the numbers? We look at the percent of cases that are investigated within 24 hours of the receipt of the complaint. And we look at the percentage of contacts that have been resolved within 48 hours. And we look at the next dial, the risk to vulnerable populations. We look at the number of outbreaks in our long-term care facilities where our vulnerable seniors are. And we look at the demographic and equity data to look to see if there's some inequities amongst our people. And there are some inequities in the percentage of people who are getting this disease. Finally, we look at the dial of the healthcare system readiness, and that's measured by the number of hospital beds that are available should this surge, the number of ICU beds that are available, the number of ventilators that are available, and very importantly, what the PPE procurement is and how much it matches with our needs. So we are being, I think, strategic about this by looking at all of that underlying data, and all of these figures most of these are on our website. Some are going to be forthcoming as we stand up the contact tracing army. And I want to say to reiterate that those healthcare officials are right, and so are the business people who are really want to get back in the saddle and open up their businesses. Look, it's tough having a business that's not open right now. It's tough worrying about whether you're going to be able to keep your business. It's tough being unemployed. Those folks want to have a success. And so do I. And I think the success here is to only go through this experience once. That'll be a success. And that's what we're intending to do here.
All right. I think that's it for questions. Any last words, Governor?
No, I just want to thank everyone who has helped us design this reopening Washington plan. I think it's comprehensive. It's strategic. It's data-driven. It responds to the desire of Washingtonians to reopen their businesses and get back to work. It responds to the need to only do this once, and it responds to the Washington character of being resilient and unified and really building a great economy. I believe we're going to do those things, and when we do, we're going to be proud of our state as we are now. Until then, please wash your hands. Thank you.
That was a press conference with Washington Governor Jay Inslee in the middle of this past afternoon. where he announced he will extend his statewide stay-at-home order until Sunday, May 31st. Governor Inslee said there will be a four-phase process to reopen the state's economy called Reopen Washington, and that some counties without many COVID-19 cases would be able to apply to the state health department for variances from his order. He said Washington has not won against COVID-19 yet, and social distancing may have to continue after May 31st, depending on how the state does. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. We'll be back with more in a moment.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by the Environmental Defense Institute, actively engaged with issues involving the Idaho National Laboratory, a Department of Energy nuclear site. EDI advocates for environmentally sound nuclear policy decisions.
As a result of the current local and national health crisis, KRFP has postponed the annual Real Radio Dinner until June the 6th. We will also not be hosting our usual Ren Fair booth since this year's Ren Fair has been canceled. KRFP depends on these two major fundraisers to keep operating. We are now in a financial emergency, having not enough funds on hand to pay our operating expenses due to the postponement and cancellation of these two major funding events. KRFP values the health of its volunteers and listeners, and at the same time we recognize our role as a valuable source of information and a unique form of social connection in this time of crisis, when most of us are isolating at least to some extent. This can mean long hours at home. KRFP is there for you, providing updated information on the coronavirus pandemic both through very thorough national programming and during local newscasts on Morning Mix and Evening Report.
There's a natural mystic blowing through the air. If you listen carefully now, you will hear.
We are reporting on how the spread of the virus is impacting people on the loose, local closures and cancellations, and the social and economic issues surrounding the near shutdown of major human activities worldwide. We have several ways you can help to remedy the financial crisis KRFP faces at this time.
Things are not the way they used to be. I won't tell no lie. One and all got to face reality.
You can buy tickets for the rescheduled radio dinner and auction for June 6th. You can go to the KRFP.org website, click on Support KRFP on the menu bar, and choose your way to support community-based real radio on the Palouse through this crisis and beyond. Or you can send a membership check of any amount to KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843.
こちらは KRFP Moscow, Idaho, 米国。
And we have a programming announcement. Because of the coronavirus, many of our KRFP DJs are broadcasting from home or sending in their shows from home, and you can hear them as we play them. Renaissance Fair is canceled for this year. It had been scheduled for tomorrow and Sunday this weekend. But KRFP will be broadcasting music performed live at Moscow Renaissance Fair last year in 2019 and other previous years. Tune in Saturday, 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. and Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. for sets from local and regional musicians, all performed before a live, enthusiastic Ren Fair audience. Some of the bands you might hear, Simba and the Exceptional Africans, Marty Itreberg, Delta G, OK OK, Palouse 4-0 Experience, the Dodgy Mountain Men, Natalie Greenfield, and more. We announced that Finn Riggins might be among them. It turned out that the recording did not come out of Finn Riggins playing in 2018, so we won't have that. So listen here at KRFP 90.3 or online at krfp.org. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. We now turn to our second featured segment on the KRFP Evening Report, an interview with Democratic Latah County Commissioner Tom Lamar about work the county has done to combat coronavirus. Lamar's Republican opponent for county commissioner in this November's election, Gabriel Wrench of Moscow, along with Caleb Bauma, organized an anti-social distancing rally called the Liberate Moscow Rally at Moscow City Hall. The rally took place Monday, April 20th. About 200 people packed a sidewalk near the south steps of Moscow City Hall for the rally. Few, if any, of the participants were practicing social distancing, and very few wore masks. Wrench is a Christ Church deacon and a vice president of the Moscow-based Economic Modeling Specialists International, or EMC. Here is Wrench speaking to the rally from a concrete platform, which is part of City Hall, abutting the South City Hall steps.
On March 13th, our city council signed a resolution for 7 days that came with a series of social distancing recommendations. Then 3 days later, March 16th, they extended that resolution to May 5th. On March 20th, Mayor Lambert issued a public health emergency order limiting gatherings of 10 or more people, effectively shutting down most of our downtown businesses, which has led to Latah County losing more than 3,000 jobs and over $22 million of revenue. This public health order has been extended to May 5th. On March 25th, Brad Little issued a stay-at-home order, which has been extended to April 30th. Now, because of the way messaging gets lost in our postmodern media world, this needs to be stated up front. Of course we care about those who have died from COVID. Amen. Just like we care about those who died from H1N1, the flu, and so forth. Of course we care about those who are at high risk of dying from COVID, the vulnerable, the elderly. What we are against is the decisions made in fear, the politicalization of this pandemic, and the draconian, warrantless measures taken by our city officials and in Boise. So this brings me to the stated reason for our protest. The first, the cure is worse than the virus. Latah County has lost over 3,000 jobs with an economic impact loss of over $22 million in revenue. This is in contrast to only 3 known COVID cases in our county and 0 deaths. Secondly, the Moscow City Council, despite their good intentions, have based their decisions off bad data initially modeled out of China, Iran, and Italy. Even the updated modeling has proven to be untrustworthy, especially in light of the geographical, regional, economic differences in our city. In the last 2 weeks, studies have come out of Stanford and USC finding that most likely the virus has been around for a long time. These findings significantly drive down the mortality rates, placing them in the range of the standard flu and H1N1 range, and demonstrates that herd immunity is the best path forward. The curse is worse than disease. Thirdly, the more reasonable approach in all this is for the elderly and others vulnerable to this to self-quarantine.
That was Republican candidate for Latah County Commission Gabriel Wrench of Moscow speaking at the anti-social distance protest at Moscow City Hall April 20th. Wrench is a Christ Church deacon and vice president at Moscow-based Economic Modeling Specialists International, also known as EMC. The rally was attended by about 200 people who mostly crowded around the south steps of the city hall to hear the speech. Most did not practice social distancing, nor did most wear masks. As previously noted on this newscast, the Moscow City Council yesterday voted unanimously to rescind their emergency orders, closing non-essential businesses that cannot maintain social distancing. The orders, which have been in place since mid-March, would have expired next Tuesday anyway. Wrench is challenging two-term incumbent Democrat Tom Lamar in this November's election for one of the 3 seats on the Latah County Commission. Neither Wrench or Lamar faces a primary challenge. The winner will serve a 2-year term. The race is the only contested Latah County office race this year. Democratic County Commissioner Kathy LaFortune is unopposed for a 4-year term. Republican County Sheriff Richie Skiles and Democratic County Prosecutor Bill Thompson are also unopposed. And the third county commissioner, Republican Dave McGraw, is not up for re-election until 2022. On Saturday of last week, I asked County Commissioner Tom Lamar to respond to some of Wrench's comments and to discuss the county's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Lamar said county officials began promoting warnings about the coronavirus Monday, March 2nd, and declared a state of emergency in Latah County Monday, March 16th. The county restricted access to county buildings to employees and patrons by appointment only on Wednesday, March 18th, and issued an order restricting gatherings at the Latah County Event Center to 10 or fewer people on Thursday, March 19th. Commissioners restricted gatherings in unincorporated parts of the county Wednesday, March 25th, the same day Republican Governor Brad Little issued his social distancing order closing non-essential businesses in the state. Here's our interview with Latah County Commissioner Tom Lamar. We're with Latah County Commissioner Tom Lamar, a Democrat. He is running for re-election on the for the seat that will have a two-year term in 2020. His challenger is Republican Gabriel Wrench of Moscow. You're both of Moscow. And I'm calling, this interview is about a response to a very unique speech given by your challenger, Republican Gabriel Wrench, at a Liberate Moscow protest, which was held at City Hall. And according to the newspaper, attended by about 200 people. I did not get close enough to record it, although I did observe it and stay on the perimeter. People were not observing social distancing. For the most part, people were not wearing masks, and they're gathered around the south steps of City Hall, and Gabriel Wrench was standing on a sort of, they have a platform next to the steps on the south side of the City Hall and giving the speech. And it was called a Liberate Moscow protest. And one of the things that was mentioned, that there was a study by a group called Restart Idaho, which ranked the amount of jobs lost in all the counties in Idaho. And it says that Latah County has lost 3,000 jobs because of social distancing and business closed down. And I would assume that would be temporary until things start, restarting with the economy and we start rolling back the social distancing rules. I want to ask if you maybe question that number, and what do you think is the actual economic impact on Latah County at this point?
Well, clearly the closure of many businesses or the modification, the severe modification of many businesses, like a lot of restaurants that are doing curbside takeout now, has had a definite economic impact, not just in Latah County or in Moscow, but throughout the United States and actually throughout the world, right? So this is a situation, by definition, a global pandemic is something that impacts the entire world. And not only is it a healthcare issue crisis, but it is also an economic crisis, and you know we're definitely seeing that here and everywhere. But you know, in order to protect people's lives, we've acted locally and also statewide and nationally to slow the spread of the virus and. That involves closing businesses because businesses is a very common way for people to get very close to each other and share the same space. And so from an epidemiological perspective, closing businesses is critical. I mean, I totally can understand the frustration over the closure of businesses, the calls for social distancing and the orders to self-isolate. I mean, many people have lost their jobs, and for others, it's just a very huge inconvenience. But I also understand the science of a rapidly spreading virus with a high rate of death. And in order to slow or stop the spread of the disease, we must break the chain of transmission that would otherwise allow a person not showing symptoms from shedding that virus and infecting people all around them. My personal frustration aside, with the shutdown and the inconveniences and the hugely terrible impact on the economy, leadership means making tough decisions that protect the lives of our county residents, and we did that. We had to make really fast, strong decisions locally. If you remember, in early March, there was very little leadership coming forward from the federal government, very little leadership coming forward from the state government. We at the county worked very closely with the city of Moscow and the other cities within Latah County to unify our efforts.
But what happened is the city declared the shutting down of restaurants and bars and so forth on March 20th. Brad Little declared his statewide on March 25th, the statewide stay-at-home order. So the county didn't have to act once Brad Little acted.
Right.
Yeah, but we actually acted the morning that the state acted. We started acting at the very beginning of March, giving warnings and doing educational work with residents saying, hey, this is coming. These are the things you need to do to protect yourself from a virus. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Recommending social distancing. Those were happening early on. By mid-March, we were closing the courthouse. So we started closing the courthouse, preventing people from going into the courthouse. We were actually working in concert with the Idaho Supreme Court and the district court of this region on those issues of just the courthouse itself. That happened before Moscow acted. Closed some, other county buildings. We ended the any activities taking place at the fairgrounds inside. There was a gun show that was being planned, and some other things that were getting ready to take place. And so we ended those contracts because of the virus. City of Moscow came out with their closures. By that Wednesday, a couple of days later, we were also passing that same ordinance on a countywide level for all the unincorporated areas of Latah County. And then we worked with the other cities to do the same thing in their cities. So Deary, Troy, Genesee, Potlatch. This is not, we had extremely good relationships with the various cities and the county government to help move this forward. And as a testimony to our quick action, right now we have only 4 confirmed cases and no deaths in Latah County. And this is not over, but at least these numbers right now on this date is a sign that we did exactly the right thing.
Does the county have a moratorium in place that goes till May 5th like the city does? Okay. So Brad Little's going to start rolling things out statewide or changing things on May 1st, but we've got 5 more days in the city and the county then.
Yeah, that's true. There are a couple things I wanted to say about that. So one is that the dates are true, that on May 1, his plan is to start the plan that's in rebound.idaho.gov. The plan is the first eligible date for something to happen is May 1. There are conditions with their 4 steps, right, that have roughly 2-week windows in them, so that goes over a 2-month period of time. There are, but within that time frame of 8 weeks, there are some pretty rigorous conditions that are in place that must be met before the next stage can be entered. And it's all based on levels of disease and where we are within the state. Now, everybody knows by looking at the state dashboard that all the counties are different. I mean, we have 44 counties in the state of Idaho, and we have slightly different situations, and in some cases, extremely different situations in those different counties. And it goes to, you know, how the disease spread differently in different parts of the state. So Blaine County is, if not the highest caseload per 100,000 residents, its number is like, it's over 2,000 cases per 100,000 people. Now, there aren't 100,000 people in Blaine County, but the ratio is that. If it's not the highest county per 100,000 in the United States, it's among the top few. You know, remember what was going on in February was ski season. So we have lots of people coming into Boise and then flying into Haley and going skiing, coming from wherever, and then moving around the state or flying back home or whatever it was, and in the process getting people sick. And so we have a lot of people in Blaine County that were contaminated and got sick. And, of course, we have deaths. We also have pretty high numbers but fairly low, relatively low ratios within Ada County, Canyon County, and other places. And then the county with the highest death rate per capita is Nez Perce County, just south of us. Nez Perce County and Lewiston did not do any local actions like we did.
So why is it important for areas without any cases or with very, very few cases to continue social distancing?
So that goes to the science of the disease itself. The fact and the science of this disease is that you can be asymptomatic for several days before experiencing symptoms, and actually even longer than just a few days. It can be quite a bit longer. Some people don't really show symptoms. But those same people that don't show symptoms can also shed the virus. And in the process of shedding the virus, they're contaminating other people potentially if they are in close quarters with people. And so social distancing, the whole concept of social distancing is the ability to be away from other people while you're shedding virus or while that person is shedding virus towards you. It's a way of breaking the chain of transmission. And we learned this in 1918, right, with the flu that came through Latah County then. We have learned from our mistakes in the past, and we are doing really great work in Latah County to make sure we don't repeat that same problem. Now, many of the deaths that happened in Latah County in 1918 happened during the second wave. And we're now just in the first wave, right? So we while it's true that it makes sense for us to start considering ways to open some businesses and allow for more interactions or more activity to take place without interactions, it's also true that we have to be very cautious about how that takes place. it makes a lot of sense now that we've got a sense of where the disease is and how prevalent it is, that as we engage in social distancing, we go to the store, whatever it might be, it does make sense to do things like wear face masks. It makes sense to take extra precautions, because if somebody gets too close to somebody else, if you've got a face mask on, it helps to protect you for those few moments where there might be, you know, a guard letting down. So none of this is fun. None of this is convenient. And it definitely is not the way we want to live our lives. But we also want to live our lives, right? We want to live. We don't want to die. So it's important that we are paying attention, because this is not just about us as individuals. It's not about me. This is about we. We want to make sure that we're protecting all of us in the community, not just, you know, the few people that are able-bodied. By having everybody engaged in good hygiene and social distancing practices, we're helping to protect all of the people in the community and in the region and the state and the nation.
Yeah, and I wanted to get to that a little bit about the nation. For example, I was reading in 360 an interview with a nurse, I think from Lewiston, who maybe didn't have that much to do, decided to go to New York City. And apparently there are nurses from this area that are going to New York City to help with the pandemic.
Yep, that's right. There are some people, because we've got such a low number of cases here, that I know there are some people that have left Moscow and are helping in some of the high demand areas. It's amazing that people do that. It's wonderful, really, that they've picked up and gone to help people.
All right.
We need more of that in this country.
Yeah. Let's just get to a couple of the arguments Gabriel Rensch was making during his speech at City Hall, outside City Hall, with the anti-social distancing protest. He made the argument, because we're finding COVID-19 was around a bit earlier than previously thought, indicating that it's been around for a long time. First known U.S. death was in Santa Clara County in California, February 6th, but everybody previously thought it was in Kirkland on February 29th. So he comes to the conclusion the mortality rate is lower and therefore herd immunity is the way forward.
Yeah, that's an incorrect conclusion drawn from those facts. It is true that the first two deaths in the country appear now that they're from Santa Clara, or took place in Santa Clara, California. There was a conference that took place in Las Vegas in early January, January 6th through 9th, and it was a high-tech kind of conference with many, many people from around the world and the United States at that conference. And several of those people lived in Santa Clara and went back to Santa Clara and died. And it's possible there's a lot of interest looking into tracing a bunch of introduction of the disease back to that particular conference. So, we don't know all of that yet, but that does not mean that it has a lower death rate. You can't make that kind of a jump in faith. I know that some of the political shows like to do that to make a point, but if we're just trying to focus on the facts and the science of the disease, it's better to focus on the facts and the science of the disease and not just speculation of, you know, an idea of something that we heard. We're learning more about this disease every single day. Twice a week, I sit in on the University of Idaho Medical Education WAMI series, ECHO, and we listen to physicians that are talking about microbiologists, physicians, epidemiologists that are talking about the disease and how they're treating the disease and how they're caring for people and how they're seeing the spread of the disease. So we're looking at statistics, you know, constantly on this, trying to learn more. It's great when local elected officials can participate in this kind of effort because we need good science in order to make good decisions. And, you know, I wish that we had had early leadership on this at the federal level that we did not have. That would have been very good to help protect us. There are definitely some failings there. I've been listening to some of the presentations that Governor Cuomo from New York has made, and when he sees when the federal government does something right, he says the federal government does something right. And when he says that the federal government is doing something wrong, he will say it. And it's very refreshing to get that look from governors that are pretty frustrated with how imbalanced how the whole thing has gone. I've talked to some high-level supply chain people in the manufacturing area and in big businesses, and they're pretty frustrated with a lack of leadership at the federal level, and really we see a kind of bidding wars between different states, and whether that's PPE or medical equipment or tests, all of that is pretty frustrating. We should be working together on all of these issues. So,
Tom Lamar, what is wrong with the idea that your opponent in the county commission election is saying that elderly and at risk should just self-quarantine, and that would be a way to deal with it?
So I think that's based on the concept that the higher death rates happen at people with more years behind them, I guess older people.
Yes, indeed.
And that's true. It's also true that people with compromised immune systems are also having problems. So people that might be diabetic or overweight or have any number of other issues that can compromise their immune system, whether they're smokers, whether they're vapors, there's a whole bunch of things that affect people's susceptibility of more severe case or death. Men are more likely to die than women. There are all sorts of various factors that go into this. But we are one community, and we have to stand out and look out for each other, and that's what we're doing. Here's an example of why that theory doesn't really work very well. So it's like 25% of the deaths that have happened in the United States so far. At the last count, I just looked at the numbers just before we started talking, we've had 53,391 people die. That's 6,000 more than I saw it 2 days ago. Of those 53,391, roughly 25% of those people have died in nursing homes. A lot of the people that care for the people in nursing homes are young, underpaid caregivers, and they're out in the community and they're fine. You know, they're invincible. I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm going to go out and live my life, and then I'm going to go in and care for elderly people. If those same people are exposing themselves in bars and restaurants, at friends' parties, at, you know, on the street, whatever, in businesses and grocery stores, and then they're asymptomatic for 2 or 4 or 5 days, and meanwhile they're caring for people in nursing homes, and then they get sick, they've just spent 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 days contaminating some of the people that are most likely to die. We have to work. We're all together in this. It's a community. this first wave, we needed to shut down and protect everybody here. And as we move forward in the future, we might have some opportunities to change how we're doing this and be more specific. But with the lack of testing, with the lack of resources that came from various governmental sources that have access to those resources, with the inability of us to know exactly who's carrying the disease and who doesn't, we needed to use a broad community-wide approach in order to combat this virus transmission. And by we, I don't mean Latah County. By we, I mean all the governments in this nation. There's 3,069 county governments in this country that are doing more work as a government than some of the federal level stuff. We're seeing incredible efforts by cities, and counties, and states to help protect people. And yes, the federal government is now engaging quite a bit more than it was in the beginning of this. But had they been engaged in the beginning of this thing and not denying it, I think we would be in a better place than we are right now.
Now, I've heard secondhand that the police chief in Moscow has confirmed that he believes that the protest at City Hall, April 20th, with 200 people, not social distancing at all, was illegal. And we have the Deputy Idaho Attorney General Brian Kane has written an analysis of the law saying how Governor Little's declaration, stay-at-home orders, and so forth are constitutionally allowed and legal. And yet we have not only your opponent candidate for county commission standing up and, you know, organizing the event, but two Republican candidates for the state legislature, Dan Foreman and Hari Heath, were photographed also at that protest, that illegal protest. You know, what are your thoughts about, people running for the state legislature participating so, you know, blatantly in something that is illegal? And yeah, do you think it could be a super spreader event? I mean, I believe that's one of the reasons a gathering like this would be illegal, right?
Right. Well, the whole reason why it's illegal is because we're trying to make sure that people are not in gatherings spreading the disease with each other. You know, hopefully this won't lead to more spread. Hopefully nobody at that rally, was sick. Hopefully nobody was carrying the disease and shedding viruses. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there. I was definitely didn't think it was a good idea to be there. I didn't think it was a good idea to organize the protest. I think it's frankly irresponsible. I totally understand the frustration of, you know, the economy being shut down. I get it. I totally hear what people are saying about that and feel that same frustration. But it's the leadership issue. If we're going to lead people away from potential death, we need to make sure we're taking strong decisions and helping keep people safe. And I don't think it should have been organized like that. I think there are other ways of expressing dissatisfaction, but you know, it happened. I understand that it's not always easy as a law enforcement officer to decide exactly what enforcement should take place, and it's not really up to me to second guess the decisions that the police chief made in terms of not giving people, you know, citing people or arresting people or whatever they might have done in that particular case. I know we also don't want to fill up the jails with more people that could be sick. So I think there are a lot of issues that are you know, part of the decision making that the police need to do in various places.
And I suppose the county would put their input in because the county does run the jail.
Right, the county runs the jail. I mean, I speak to a lot of university classes and let people know, look, here's the difference between city and county. If you're in the city of Moscow and you get a DWI, DUI, you are underage drinking, you get arrested, you go to jail, you're arrested by a city police officer, you go to the jail, you're being held by the county sheriff. The county sheriff and the police department, they talk every day about everything, and they talked about this, and I know that, you know, there's a lot of discussions about, you know, how the best way to handle this is.
It's not possible to social distance in the Latah County Jail if it's full, right?
Not very easily. Every time that I've been in the jail, we inspect it quite a few times every year, and it's not, yeah, there's not a lot of social distancing.
Okay.
So I don't think it was a good idea to gather people in close proximity like that, but they did, and hopefully they recognize, maybe they've learned something and decide not to do that anymore. But and maybe they'll be satisfied now that the governor's announced a plan for starting to, you know, have a timeline for starting to reopen stuff. But so maybe they'll feel like their concerns were met. But we also won't be restarting very quickly if we end up having a bunch more cases showing up in the community. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Okay.
We're just at the beginning of this, right? We really literally are just at the beginning. I mean, I have no idea how long it's going to take for scientists to come up with the vaccination, but we are able to function with various other diseases in our presence, like flu, various other diseases. But we do so because of vaccinations. Polio, there's a vaccination. Flu, we have vaccinations. We have a way of keeping the entire community from getting deathly ill very quickly. And this particular coronavirus has a very high rate of transmission. It's very easily spread, and it's spread by people that are showing no symptoms. And so it's likely that it's spreading out in front of itself. It's like a wave cresting out over in front of the wave itself. It also has a high death rate. So all of those factors together means we have to take it seriously. And the only way to get herd immunity that doesn't cause a lot of people to die is vaccination. There is another way of herd immunity, and that's just letting the virus spread rampant through the community. But I'm not interested in doing that because that means people die.
All right, Tom. Thank you very much. I mean, you may not have anything to add because we've been going for quite a while. So, my usual last question is if you have anything to add about the whole coronavirus thing.
I, as I said, we're still learning a lot, and we'll know a lot more later than we do right now. And I wish we knew what we knew now when we were younger, right? That's how that song goes. But anyway, thanks so much for taking the time.
That was Latah County Commissioner Tom Lamar of Moscow speaking on KRFP. He was recorded Saturday of last week. The Democrat Lamar is running for re-election this year. He is challenged by Republican Gabriel Wrench of Moscow. who is a Christchurch deacon who organized the Liberate Moscow Antisocial Distancing protest at City Hall, attended by about 200 people, April 20th. You heard part of Wrench's speech at the rally right before the interview with Lamar. Well, that's it for the extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, there is a hazardous weather outlook issued for central and eastern Washington and northern and north central Idaho for tomorrow and tomorrow night. Showers and thunderstorms expected Saturday. Heavy rain showers are possible Saturday night. Otherwise, the forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area is calling for 60% chance of precipitation tomorrow, slight chance of showers, then showers likely, possibly a thunderstorm in the afternoon. Some of the storms could be severe, increasing clouds, high 68. Saturday night, 90% chance of precipitation, showers and possibly a thunderstorm before midnight, then a chance of showers. Snow level 7,600 feet, lowering to 4,400 feet after midnight, low 37. Light and variable wind becoming southwest, 10 to 15 in the evening, gusts up to 25 miles an hour. New precipitations amounts between a quarter and a half inch of rain possible. 30% chance of showers on Sunday, snow level 3,600 feet, rising to 4,400 feet in the afternoon, otherwise mostly sunny, high 55, west winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho 83843. I'll repeat that address in a moment. KRFP is now going through a financial emergency. We've had to postpone the Real Radio Dinner and Auction, which normally brings in thousands of dollars for the station, until June 6th, and we may have to postpone it again. That was one of our biggest fundraisers of the year, if not the biggest. Another big fundraiser was our Renaissance Fair booth, which took place during Renaissance Fair weekend, selling heroes and other food and drink to the many thousands of fairgoers. Renaissance Fair is canceled this year, so we're in a financial emergency. If you can help out, you can send donations of any amount to that address, KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho 83843. Also, you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. As a business, you can underwrite programming on KRFP, very affordable rates, and it will let listeners know that you support KRFP and also remind them that you exist for after the coronavirus and reopenings and so forth. Also, you can adopt DJs. And we have a new Patreon button on the front page of the KRFP website. If you have a steady enough income, you can donate from your bank account a certain increment of money every month to KRFP through Patreon. I'm Lee Robartis. Kurt Morrison and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant weekend. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
KRFP is sponsored by Mikey Zeros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as gyros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh. Located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.